The 5 days seemed very long to me. I kept to myself as well as I could. Once I got away and ran to Tiris's farm. Sylvia was in the dairy. I coaxed her to come away with me. I wanted to talk to her about the choice I had to make, which, of course, she knew about. It was common knowledge. Very little in a king's house can be a secret. And everyone knew that her brother Almo hadn't even been included in the list of suitors Turnus offered to my father. When I came to her, she hoped I might ask her to reassure Almo, to tell him that he was my choice and should ask the king directly for my hand. The family had let their hopes run high, thinking my friendship with Sylvia raised her brother's status to equality with mine, as indeed it did among us young people, but not among the kings and queens, the mortal powers of our state. When Sylvia understood that I had refused to choose any of the suitors, she began to press Almo's case. When I shook my head and said, "No, Sylvia, I can't choose him." She wanted to know why. Had I not always shown him a kindness that had led him to love me? Was he not good enough for me? And so on. I said, "I love him better than any of the others. But I don't want him as my husband. And if I did, if I chose him, it would be the same as killing him. Turnus would be after him like a hawk on a mouse." It was a stupid comparison, and Sylvia took it ill. "Even if your father refused to protect my brother, I think our household has a few good warriors of its own," she said stiffly. "Oh, Sylvia, I'm the mouse. The mouse in the field when they cut the hay and lay the ground all bare. Everybody watching me, nowhere to go. I run about and run about in my mind and can't find anywhere to hide. Everywhere I look, there's Turnus, with his blue eyes and his smile and my..." I stopped myself. "And my mother trusts him," I said.
"You don't?"
she asked curiously. "No. He has no piety. He looks only at himself."
"Why shouldn't he? He's rich, he's handsome, he's a king."
Her irony wasn't entirely ill-natured, but she had no sympathy for me. She was hurt for Almo, and wouldn't let me off easily. I think she knew I was frightened, but wouldn't ask me what I was afraid of, so I couldn't speak to her as I longed to. All the same, we parted friends. She knew well enough that Almo had been in over his head, and that indeed he would have put himself and his family in mortal danger by winning a woman King Turnus wanted. She gave me a long hug and a kiss when we parted, and said, "Oh, I'm sorry all this came up. I wish there weren't any men in the world. I wish we could go down to the river together the way we did last spring."
"Maybe we will," I said,
but my heart was low. I kissed her, and so we parted. I went back through the fields, trying not to cry. I was near tears, or in tears half the time, and sick of it. There was nobody in the world whom I could talk to, or who could understand me, but the poet. Maruna might have understood. Indeed, perhaps she did. But I couldn't talk about my mother to her. To ask slaves to speak or hear dishonor of their master is unjust. It puts them at risk. There are always tale-bearers, toadies, among household slaves. How could it be otherwise? No room in a king's house is without an ear at the door. I knew I had Maruna's sympathy, and that was much help to me. But since I couldn't protect her, I couldn't confide in her. Most of the other women and girls simply wondered why I didn't jump at Turnus's offer. Old Vestina sang his praises daily, always to a chorus of sighs and giggles. And my mother's affectionate pressure and persuasion in favor of Turnus continued. until 4 days had passed, and I must make my choice the next day. Then her exasperation with me burst out all at once in a fit of fury, like those of years ago. She came into my room just after I had lain down to sleep. She was in her sleeping gown, carrying a tiny oil lamp, its flame no larger than a caper bud. She was there suddenly, looming tall and bulky in the loose white gown, her black hair loose round her white face. "I don't know what game you're playing, or how far you think you can lead your father by the nose, Lavinia," she said in a low, harsh voice. "But I tell you now, you will marry Turnus and be queen of Ardea. You don't have to cower and whine about it. If you don't like Turnus, don't worry. He may not like you all that much either. It's a political marriage, not a rape. There's one thing a girl is good for, and that's to be married well. And you're no different or better than any other girl. So do your duty, as I did mine. If you ruin this chance, I'll never forgive you. I'll never forgive you." It wasn't what she said so much as how she said it that terrified me. She stood very close to the bed, and every moment I felt that she was about to strike me, to claw me with her nails, as she had done long ago. Her voice shook and hissed, and her breath came hard. "Say you will marry Turnus," she said. "Say you will." I said nothing. I couldn't. A strange noise came from her, a kind of shrieking groan, and she turned and ran out of the room. After a while I got up, for there was no sleep in that bed, and crept out into the courtyard. No one else was awake. I sat on the wooden bench under the laurel tree, and watched the slow sliding of stars over the roofs of the Regia. The chill of the night seemed to come into my mind and make it cool and clear. I saw that I must marry Turnus. It was inevitable. To accept another suitor would be to bring civil war into the kingdom. His agreement with the others meant nothing. Turnus had to compete, to win, to be master. He would never let another man have a woman he had claimed. Marriage was my duty and my destiny. My mother was right, even if she spoke in her own interest, not in mine. In the morning I would tell my father I was ready for him to accept Turnus as my husband. The Great Bear stood high over the Father River, over Etruria. The leaves of the laurel whispered in the mild flow of the night wind. I thought of those 3 strange nights in Albunea, where the faint stink of the sulphur pools always hung in the dark air, and I sat talking with a shadow, a dying man who hadn't yet been born, and who knew my past and my future and my soul, who knew who it was that I should marry, the true hero. But here, now, in the courtyard of my house, all that seemed distant, blurred and obscure, a false dream that had nothing to do with waking life. I wouldn't think about it again. I would never go back to Albunea. For a moment I heard the voice like no other in my memory. When the poet first came, when he first stood there in the altar place, he had said that Faunus spoke from the trees of Albunea to King Latinus, telling him not to marry his daughter to a man of Latium. Then, seeing me startled and troubled by that, he said, "I think it hasn't happened yet. Faunus hasn't spoken to Latinus. Perhaps it never will happen." And he said that perhaps he had imagined it, that it was a dream within a dream. And I had imagined it. It hadn't happened. It wouldn't happen. False dreams, visions, follies. The roofs were standing hard black against the paling eastern sky when I went in and lay down for a little while. It was a day of worship, and I was up before the sun. I put on the red-edged toga I wore as a child and still wore for the rites, and went to wake my father, calling with the ritual words at his door, "Do you wake, King? Waken!" And soon he came out, also in his red-edged robe, the loose corner pulled up over his head for worship, and we went to the altar in the atrium. A number of the house people were with us, among them my mother, who didn't usually attend the common rituals. She stood quite close behind me as I scattered the salsamola on the altar. I had the sense that she intended to be close to me, to keep me under her eyes, within reach, all that day, till she got what she wanted. The warmth, the pressure of her body so close behind me was palpable, and I wanted to escape it. I moved closer to my father as he held a little pitch-dipped stick in Vesta's fire and lifted it to light the altar torches, murmuring the sacred words. I don't know if the pitch scattered, or a wind blew in, or a hand moved, but I suddenly saw a strangeness all around me, a flickering movement of brightness. There were voices crying, screaming, "Lavinia! Lavinia! Her hair's on fire! She's burning!" I put up my hands to my head and felt a queer soft movement in the air about it. Sparks danced and leapt around me, and I smelled smoke. As I turned, I saw through a yellowish, dim cloud my mother standing there, not at arm's length from me. She stared with wild eyes at something above my head. I turned and ran from her, ran through the people, through the atrium, out to the courtyard. Flame and yellow smoke followed me. Sparks scattered from me. People screamed. I heard my father call my name. I ran to the fountain pool under the laurel and threw myself down, my face in the water, my hair in the water. My father was there kneeling by me, lifting me up. "Lavinia, little one, daughter, my daughter," he whispered. "Are you hurt? Are you hurt? Let me see." I was very bewildered, but I saw amazement dawning through the horror in his face. He passed his hand over my dripping head, down my lank, wet hair. "Can it be you took no harm?" "What was it, Father? There was a fire." "A fire above your head, leaping, blazing. I thought it was your hair. I thought the torch had caught it. Are you not hurt, not burned?" I put my own hand on my head. I was dizzy, but my scalp and hair felt, as usual, only sopping wet. Nothing was burned but the corner of my toga, which I had worn pulled up over my head at the altar. All that corner of the white, red-bordered wool was scorched black. The whole household was gathered around us by now, filling the courtyard, shouting and crying and asking and answering. My mother stood by the trunk of the laurel, her face fixed, blank. My father looked up at her and said, "She took no harm, Amata. She is all right." She answered something, I don't know what. Maruna's mother pressed forward. She knelt beside us and touched my head and cheeks gently. A license allowed her as a healer. She looked then at my father and said sternly, imperiously, "An omen, King. Speak the omen." And he obeyed the slave. He stood up. He looked down at me, and up into the great tree, and spoke. "War," he said. All the people fell silent at his voice. "War," he said again. And then, as if struggling with the words, or as if the words pushed themselves from his throat and mouth without his will, "Bright fame, bright glory will crown Lavinia, but she brings her people war." Gradually everything and everyone got quieted down. People scattered out, talking all the way, to their morning work. Vestina took me off to dry my hair and weep and fuss over me, while the red-bordered toga, with the blackened burnt corner, passed from hand to hand among the marveling women. The rite that had been interrupted must be begun again and carried out. That was so much on my mind that at last I broke free from the women to go assist my father. But he sent me back at once to the women's quarters, telling me to send Maruna to help him. I should rest, he said, and come to him later. I was glad of it, for I found myself shaky and lightheaded. I think I need to eat something, I said, when I came back to the women's side, and Vestina cried, of course, poor lamb, and sent girls off to fetch curds and honey and spelt porridge, all of which I ate and felt better. My mother had been in the room with us all along, but didn't join the chatter. She sat at her great loom. I was a good spinning woman. I made as strong and even a thread as any, but I was slow and clumsy at the loom. Amata was by far the best of our weavers, working fast, with a steady rhythm and utter concentration. When she was weaving, she was aware of nothing else, and her face looked rapt and calm. The very fine woolen thread I had been spinning all this spring was for the piece she was working on now, a full breadth of the finest white fabric, the kind you can gather yards of into your hand and pass through a finger ring. Today, as the women at last began talking about something besides the mysterious flame of fire, and how the yellow smoke had swirled behind me when I ran, and how sparks flew all through the house, yet nothing caught fire from them, and so on, and on, my mother turned round from the loom and beckoned to me. I went to her. "Do you know what it is I'm making, Lavinia?" she asked with the strangest smile, a wide, blind smile that was almost coy. As soon as she asked me the question, I knew the answer. But I said, "A summer pala." "Your wedding gown. You'll wear it when you marry. See how fine it is." "Your weaving's always beautiful, Mother." "You'll wear it when you marry. When you marry him," she said, almost as if it were the refrain of a song. And she turned back to the loom and took up the shuttle. And as she wove, she whispered that half-song under her breath, "You'll wear it when you marry him." About midday, I went alone to my father's rooms. As I crossed the courtyard, I paused under the laurel tree and asked the powers of the tree and the spring, the Lar of the household, and my dear Penates, to be with me and help me. All I had thought and seen so clearly last night, sitting there on the bench under the stars, all I had so firmly and reasonably resolved, was gone, burnt away in a puff of heatless flame, a coil of yellow smoke. I knew what I must say, but I wanted help in saying it. My father embraced me, and tried to make certain once again that I was quite unhurt, unburnt, unshaken. "I am well, Father," I said. "I was terribly hungry, though. I ate everything they brought from the kitchen." That reassured him, as I knew it would. "Now may I speak to you about my suitors?" He sat down on the chest against the wall and gave one grave nod. "I said I would ask you today to give me to one of them." A nod. "But because of what happened this morning, the omen, I ask you not to ask me my choice, but instead to go to Albunea and ask the powers there. Whatever they tell you, I will obey." As I spoke, He looked up at me heavily from under his heavy gray-black eyebrows. He listened. When I had spoken, he thought for some while. At last, he nodded once again.
"I will go today," he said.
"May I come with you?" Again he thought it over.
"Yes," he said.
Then he looked up at me again with the shadow of a smile and said,
"As we used to go together. Do you remember the first time? You were still a child."
But his face was melancholy. I saw that he looked very worn. I kissed his hand and said, "I'll be ready to go as soon as you like, Father."
"Sacrifices," he said. "This is... I will need... a lamb. 2. Is there a white calf? 2 lambs and a white calf, at least."
"I'll send to Tiris's Doro. He's with the cows and calves in the long meadow pasture. I can see to the animals, Father."
"Good. Do that. There are some things I must see to here before we go. A black calf better, Lavinia, if there is one. Black in that place."
That place, Albunea, that lies so close above the underworld that the shadows of the dead can come and go there easily. Black in that place. Lambing had been early that spring, and the lambs the shepherd led to me were quite large. The calf old Doro brought was small, a runt, in fact, and he wasn't altogether black, but brownish on the legs and face. Not a perfect sacrifice. My father frowned at him. I said, "He is pious, Father. See how he follows along? And he did his best to be black." Doro nodded solemnly.
"He's the blackest we've got, King," he said.
So the king nodded, and we set off. I wore the toga with the burnt corner, for it was the only sacred toga I had. Year after year my mother had put off making the red dye for a new one. Because we had to lead the animals, and perhaps because my father felt some unease or mistrust in the air, we were quite a troop. It wasn't as when he and I walked there long ago, he carrying the young lamb, or when I walked with Maruna. She came with me, indeed. But also there was Doro with the calf, and the shepherd's boy with the lambs, and 2 slaves carrying the other offerings, and 3 of my father's guards, the men who kept the doors of the Regia, and went with him, armed, when he rode out visiting other towns or other kings. They were called his horse riders, his knights, and they did each keep a horse in the royal stable. But this was a sacred journey, and we went afoot. One after another we walked through the bright day into the evening. We came to the little Prati, and followed it upstream, and I remembered the rocky ford of the river where I had seen blood in the water in my dream. The knights and Maruna and the slaves stopped at the outskirts of the forest. The men would camp there. Maruna would go to the woodcutter's house. Doro and the shepherd boy led the animals, and Latinus and I carried the other offerings on into the forest of Albunea. By the time the sacrifice was completed, it was night, the altar fire and torches giving the only light under the dark trees. Doro and the boy took the skinned carcasses back to their camp, where the men would have the first feast on the meat. My father reversed the torches. Their flames died in the earth. He stood before the altar, where the fire still fed on the fat of the sacrifice, his head shrouded, murmuring the words of worship and humble request. I sat on the fleece of one of the lambs, listening. I feared and longed to hear the grandfather's voice speak, answering him from those dark, silent trees. But I had scarcely slept the night before, and the day had been long and strange. I was so tired I couldn't keep my eyes open. I saw the little leaping gold of the altar flame waver and blur. Then I was lying down, looking up into the branch-circled sky, dense with stars as the sea beach is dense with sand, a pavement of white fire. And it, too, wavered and blurred. I woke. The stars blazed, but other stars. The fire was dead. A small owl called from far on the right. He, ye. And another answered, from yet farther. E, e. He was there, the shadow. He stood between me and the altar. His tall form was vague in the gray starlight. On the far side of the altar, near the wall, I saw a glint of bronze, a motionless bulk on the ground. My father, sleeping. The feel of the air was that of the hour before the beginning of dawn. The time when the dying die, my poet said, very softly. I sat up, trying to see him more clearly. I was frightened, distressed, and didn't know why, and knew why. I whispered, "Are you dying?" He nodded. The nod of a head is such a small thing. It can mean so little. Yet it is the gesture of assent that allows, that makes to be. The nod is the gesture of power. The yes. The noumen, the presence of the sacred, is called by its name. "I don't have long," he said. "Oh, I wish—" But wishes were no use. "Your father has heard Faunus speak," he said, with a ghost of laughter in his ghost of voice. "Then you will not marry Turnus. No fear of that." I stood up, facing him. Though he spoke so gently, I was still frightened. "What will happen?" "War. The bees swarmed to the great tree. The king's daughter ran through the house with blazing hair, scattering sparks and smoke. And war and glory followed her." "Why must there be war?" "Oh, Lavinia, what a woman's question that is. Because men are men."
"Then Aeneas is coming to attack us?"
"Not at all. He comes in peace, to offer alliance to your father, and marry you, and settle down to bring up his family. He brings the gods of his household here, but he brings his sword, too, and there will be war. Battles, sieges, slaughter, slave-taking, town-burning, rape. And men who rant and boast, and then kill sleeping men, and men who kill young boys, and the growing crops laid waste. All the wrong that men can do is done. Justice, mercy, does Mars care for them?"
His voice had grown stronger. Not loud, but curiously strident, so that I glanced at my father to see if he had heard. He slept on, unmoving.
"I can tell you the war, Lavinia. Shall I?"
He didn't wait for my answer.
"It begins with a boy killing a deer in the woods. There's a good cause for war, as good as any other. First to die is young Almo. You know him. An arrow in his throat chokes off his speech and breath with blood. Next, old Galysus, who's rich and used to being in control, tries to keep them from fighting, comes between them, and has his face smashed in for his pains.
And then Turnus sees his chance, and war begins in earnest. No man will spare another man in this battle, though he beg for his life. Ilioneus kills Lucetius. Liger kills Emathion. Asilas kills Coronius. Caineus kills Ortygius. Turnus kills Caineus and Itus. And Clonius, and Dioxippus, and Promulus, and Sagaris, and Idas. The blood foams from the pierced lung. The man killed while sleeping vomits blood and wine as he writhes dying. Ascanius shoots his steel-pointed arrow through Remulus's head, and Turnus's javelin pierces Antiphates' throat and lodges in the lung till the steel grows warm, and his sword cleaves Pandarus's skull between the temples so that the man falls to the ground in his brain-spattered armor, his head dangling in two halves from his neck. And when Aeneas joins the battle, his spear crashes through Maeon's shield and breastplate, on through his body, to sever Alcanor's arm from his shoulder. And Pallas drives his sword into Hisbo's swollen chest, and sweeps Thimber's head from his neck, and severs Larides' hand that twitches and clutches with dying fingers at the sword. And Helysus kills Ladon, and Pheres, and Demodocus, and lops off Stramonius's hand raised against him, and strikes Thoas in the face with a stone, scattering fragments of skull mixed with blood and brains. And Turnus hurls his steel-tipped lance of oak through Pallas's shield and breast, and the boy falls forward eating dirt with his bloody mouth. And Turnus puts his foot on the corpse and tears away Pallas's golden sword belt, boasting of the plunder that will be his death. Then, hearing of this, Aeneas rushes out again in blind rage against the enemy. And though Magus begs him for mercy, Aeneas bends the man's head back and cuts his throat. And he kills Anxur, he kills Antaeus, he kills Lucas, he kills Numa. He kills Tawny Camers, he kills Nephias, he kills Liger and Lucagus. And Turnus is saved from him only by the goddess who loves him and draws him away from the battle. But Mezentius, the tyrant of Cyrene, kills Habrus, he kills Letagus, striking him full in the mouth and face with a huge rock. He hamstrings Palmus and leaves him slowly writhing. He kills Evanthes and Mimas. Acron, dying from Mezentius's spear cast, hammers the dark earth with his heels. Caedicus kills Alcathous, and Secrator kills Hedaspes, and Rapo kills Parthenius and Orses. Messapus kills Clonius as he lies fallen from his horse, and Agus is killed by Valerius. Thronius is killed by Salius, and Salius by Nealces. They kill together and are killed together. Then pious Aeneas, obeying the will of fate and the gods, pierces Mezentius's groin with his spear and kills Mezentius's son Lausus as he tries to protect his father, driving his sword through the young man's body to the hilt. The point pierces the shield and the tunic his mother wove for him. Blood fills his lungs, and his life, leaving his body, flees sorrowing to the shadows. And Aeneas is sorry for the boy. But when Mezentius challenges him, he goes to meet him with a shout of joy, and though Mezentius rains darts on him, Aeneas kills his horse, then taunts the fallen man and cuts his throat. And the next day he sends Pallas's body to his father, King Evander, with four prisoners to be sacrificed alive on the grave. How do you like my poem now, Lavinia?
After a long time, I managed to answer him. That might depend on how it ends.
With the triumph of the glorious hero over his enemy, of course. He will kill Turnus, lying wounded and helpless, just as he killed Mezentius.
Who is the hero?
You know who the hero is.
He kills like a butcher. Why is he a hero?
Because he does what he has to do.
Why does he have to kill a helpless man?
Because that is how empires are founded. Or so I hope Augustus will understand it. But I don't think he will.
He turned away from me, and neither of us spoke. I had begun to cry while he sang his hideous chant of slaughter, and my face was still wet. When the poet spoke again, his voice had softened.
But that's not where it ends for you, Lavinia.
I took a step towards him, for I could no longer see his face. Tell me, then.
Not with the end of his reign, after only 3 summers and 3 winters. You may think all is over at the bloody ford of the Numicus, but it isn't there it ends, nor at Lavinium, nor Alba Longa. Not with your death, or your son's. Not with the king's, not with the consul's, the fall of Carthage, the conquest of Gaul. Not even with the murder of Julius, or Augustus's godhead. The great age returns. Maybe. I thought so once. But be of good heart, my daughter. My young grandmother. The gods of Troy are coming to a good house. Your house of Latium. And you will marry the son of spring, the son of the evening star.
I had hated him while he told that tale of slaughter. But I was losing him, now, already, moment by moment, and I loved him. Yearning to him. Wait. Only tell me. Your poem. My poem. Did you finish it? He seemed to nod, but I could hardly see him. A tall shadow in shadows. Don't go yet.
I must go, my glory. I am gone. I join the crowd. Return to darkness.
I cried out his name, went forward, reaching my arms to hold him, to keep him from death. But it was like holding a breath of the night wind. Nothing was there. I sat on the fleece, my arms around my knees, the toga with the burnt corner wrapped around me for warmth, till the sky was light above the altar place. I went then to my father and said, "Do you wake, King? Waken." He sat up. We had brought a little drinking water, for there is none near there. I gave him the flask, and he drank a swallow, and rubbed a handful of water on his face. "You heard the grandfather speak?" I said. Looking up at me, as if still not fully awake, he said,
"The voice among the trees."
I waited. He looked off into the dark trees and said in the low, level voice of prayer, but clearly,
"Do not let the daughter of Latium marry a man of Latium. Let her marry the stranger that comes, that even now is coming. And the kingdom of her sons will be far greater than the kingdom of Latium."
He looked up at me again. I nodded. "I understand. I will obey." My father got up, stiff and ponderous. He wasn't used to sleeping out on hard ground these days. He rubbed his thighs and stretched his arms painfully.
"I am old, daughter," he said. "And now I have to face those young fellows with this refusal."
He shook his head, hunched up his shoulders.
If only my sons had lived. I am too old, Lavinia.
It wasn't like him to say that. I didn't know what to say to him. I was too young to feel anything but surprised, uncomprehending pity, and I didn't want to pity my father, the king. He went off into the woods to piss, and when he came back, he was holding himself a little straighter.
"Don't be afraid," he said. "I'll take no insolence from them. I can still protect my daughter and my house and city."
We gathered up the little we had brought, and as we did so, he said,
"I could wish your mother hadn't set her mind on your marrying Turnus, but I can see, because he's her nephew, it seems to her like getting one of her sons back. Well, come along, my dear."
He set off, walking heavily, and I followed. When we came to where the men had camped, they were just waking. The sky was bright behind the eastern hills, and all the birds in the world were singing. There was a little brook there, and my father and I both knelt on the bank to wash our hands and faces. As the knights joined us, I heard my father telling them what the oracle had said. That surprised me again. I had assumed he would announce it formally at home, perhaps summoning the suitors to explain to them that their request had been denied by the powers and the ancestors. To talk about it openly now was to ensure that it would be common knowledge in Laurentum as soon as we got back, and throughout all Latium within a day or two. I couldn't think why my father had done this, unless he thought he couldn't face my mother with the news himself, and wanted her to hear it from me, or from hearsay among the women. But she came to meet us, almost running across the courtyard, flushed and beautiful in her excitement. "I know. I dreamed of you there," she cried. "I am so glad." We both stopped, staring like cattle, no doubt. She took my hands and kissed me. "I am so happy about it. About, oh, the bridal bed in Ardea. I saw it all in my dream." After a blank pause, my father said, loudly and awkwardly,
"The oracle forbids Lavinia to marry a man of Latium. She must wait for a foreign suitor."
"No, that's not what it said at all. I saw it, I heard it."
"Amata, calm yourself," he said. "We will speak of this in private. Lavinia, call the women. Take your mother with you."
And he strode off to his rooms. My mother started to run after him, then stopped, bewildered, and said to me, "What is wrong with him?" "Nothing, mother. Come with me." I tried to go on to the women's side, but she protested, and only when her women, Sicana and Lena, came to urge her to come with them, did she fall silent, the happy brightness dying out of her face, and follow me. The news was all over the house and town at once, of course. The king's daughter isn't to marry Turnus or Messapus or any of them. She's got to wait for a foreigner to come marry her. That's what the bees meant. That's why her hair caught fire yet didn't burn. War. War. Who'll fight? Who's the foreigner coming? And what will King Turnus have to say to him? And what will I have to say to him? I wondered, as everybody chattered on. Amata seemed stunned. She didn't tell us what the dream was that she had taken to be a true dream, and that the oracle had so cruelly belied. She didn't join in the general talk, didn't speak to me at all. We kept away from each other. It was easy enough. We had kept apart for 12 years. By nightfall, I was sick of the chatter and commotion, and wanted only to be free of the women, away from the house, outdoors, alone, where I could think. My mother was at her loom. I went and asked her permission to go get salt at the river mouth next day.
"Ask the king," she said, not looking away from her work.
So I went to him. He pondered a minute.
"I suppose it's safe," he said.
"Why would it not be safe?" I said, amazed. Our possession of the salt beds was one of our great strengths as a nation, and we guarded them accordingly. Nobody had tried to raid them for decades.
"I'll send Gaius with you, and take a couple of your women."
"What do we want Gaius for? I'll have Pico with the donkey to carry the salt back."
"Gaius will go with you. Go by the west path. Be back before dark."
"I can't, Father. We have to dig the salt." He frowned.
"You can do that and be back in a day easily."
"I hope to spend the night there, Father, by Tiber." I very seldom pleaded with him.
"Well, why not?"
he said after a long pause.
"My mind is vexed, troubled. I hardly know. Go on, then. Give worship to our Father River. But one night only."
As I thanked him and left, he said,
"And look out for Etruscans."
Everybody always said that when you went to Tiber, as if the northern bank were forever crowded with Etruscans waiting to leap in, swim across, carry you off, and torture you. There were awful stories about Etruscan torture. But we had always been on good terms with Caere, except when Mezentius ruled it, and it would be a mighty swimmer who swam the river there at its mouth. People said, "Look out for Etruscans," when you went to the river, the way they said, "Look out for bears," when you went up into the hills, out of habit. All the same, as I went to find Tita, to tell her to find Pico, and to tell him to be ready with the donkey in the morning, I wondered if the foreigner I was to marry might be an Etruscan. For when I wasn't in Albunea, when I was among people, the things my poet had said to me came and went in my mind, sometimes seeming as real as they did when he spoke them, but more often fading away like the shreds of a dream that vanish as you try to remember them. It was a true dream, but you can't live your life in a dream, even if it be true. Hardest of all to remember was what the poet had said last night. Was it only last night? He was dying. I didn't want to remember that. I didn't want to remember what he had sung, the endless, hideous deaths. I knew he had told me the name of the man I was to marry, his wife's name and his son's. I knew he came from the far city, Troy. I knew there was to be a war. Men would kill men. And yet, here in the courtyard of the Regia, passing by the great laurel, where women were gathered, talking and singing at their work, the names and all slipped away from me, and I wondered if the foreigner I was to marry might be an Etruscan. They were foreign enough, the Etruscans. They saw the future in the livers of sheep. I liked Maruna's bird lore, but I could do without the tortures and the sheep livers. My spirits had risen as soon as I had permission to go, and when we left the city next morning, I felt like a sparrow let go from the snare. All the trouble about suitors, the threats, the strange portents, the dark prophecies, dropped away from me. I forbade Tita to say a word about all that. We joked and told stories all the way to Tiber, and even grave Maruna laughed like a child. That was a joyous day, and that night I slept a quiet sleep on the dune under the stars. And in the twilight of morning of the next day, alone, kneeling in the mud by Tiber, I saw the great ships turn from the sea and come into the river. I saw my husband stand on the high stern of the first ship, though he didn't see me. He gazed up the dark river, praying, dreaming. He didn't see the deaths that lay before him all along the river, all the way to Rome. There was nothing but commotion and discussion and agitation in the Regia and the town all that day. Everybody knew what the oracle had told Latinus, and they all had to discuss it endlessly. And then word came across the fields of a fleet of ships seen going up the river, and of a crowd of armed strangers making camp on the Latin shore. The talk about that made me think of the great, dark, humming mutter of the swarming bees. Very early the next morning, I slipped out of the Regia and out of Laurentum without asking permission or telling anyone, and ran through the oak grove to Tyrus's farm. Sylvia was in the cool stone dairy with some of the dairy women, skimming cream. I said, "Sylvia, let's go to the river. Let's take a look at these strangers." It was usually Sylvia, not I, who proposed anything daring or dangerous, and I took her by surprise. "What do you want to see foreigners for?" she asked, a reasonable question. "Because I have to marry one." She'd heard the decree of the oracle, of course. She frowned at first, no doubt thinking of Almo. But after a minute she looked up with a half-smile. "You want to see if they have two heads?"
"Yes."
"Maybe these aren't the foreigners you have to marry one of."
"I think they are."
She was standing with a skimmer in hand, her hair tied back, her bare arms shining in the dim, cool place, and her bare feet on the wet floor. The dairy was kept very clean, sluiced out constantly with water. She couldn't resist the escapade.
"Oh, all right," she said,
and gave the skimmer and a few orders to Valenta, the dairy keeper, and came out into the sunshine with me. She put on her sandals, and we struck off across the pastures. It was 6 miles or so to the river. We had done it often in our rambles and explorations, and knew the ways through the woods. We discussed where the foreigners might have landed, for we hadn't heard a clear report yet. Sylvia thought they would have tied up at the wooden docks at Sirmo, but I had it in my head that they hadn't gone so far upstream, but had beached their ships at the place called Venticula, where the river takes a great bend to the north. Though we said nothing about it, we were both aware that if any of our countrymen saw us, whether they recognized us or not, they would rightly tell us to get back home at once, and might make sure we did so. There was a cart road to Sirmo, to Venticula only a path leading through dense woods and past the marshes of the Fossula. We kept off the cart road and the straight Pagus lanes, away from the farmhouses and shepherds' huts, following the path that wound over old grass-grown dunes and skirted swampy thickets as it neared the river, till we finally scrambled up the low forested hill above Venticula. As we came over the crest of the hill, we both realized that we weren't alone in the woods. We heard men talking, calling, the blows of an axe. Then we saw a couple of helmeted heads across a myrtle thicket, behind which we at once crouched down to hide. Sylvia had a fit of wild, silent giggles, which infected me. We crouched, shaking with crazy laughter. The soldiers crashed on down the hill, and when it had been silent for a while, except for axe blows far off, I wriggled around to the end of the thicket. From there I could look right down the hillside through the trees to the open glades by the shore. I whispered to Sylvia,
"There they are."
She crawled beside me, and we lay watching the Trojans. I saw my husband almost at once. He stood out among them, not by any ornament or richness of clothing. They were all dressed like soldiers on the march who'd been on duty a long time, and crammed into ships on the sea as well, all plain and worn and dirty. He simply stood out, the way the morning star stands out from other stars. He was a man in his 40s, with a strong face. He was sitting comfortably on the ground and laughing at something one of the other men said. They were having a picnic there, on the grass. Almost all of them were men. They had brought flatbread up from the ships, which were run up stern first along the beach. They had gathered a great basket of wild greens to pile up on the rounds of flatbread, having no meat or cheese, evidently, as well as no plates or tables. The few women among them were none of them young. One matron, smiling, presented Aeneas with a round of bread heaped with greens, which he rolled up and bit into with gusto. Close to him sat a boy of 15 or so, who looked enough like him, and looked up to him in such a way that I was sure it was his son Ascanius. With him were a very pretty boy of his age, and a beautiful youth a few years older, wearing a bent-forward red cloth cap. The woman who had served the meal sat down beside him, and set his cap straight with an unmistakably maternal fussiness, adoring him.
"They're much better looking than I thought foreigners would be,"
Sylvia whispered to me.
"That boy with the red cap is gorgeous."
I hushed her with a nudge of my elbow. I was afraid they might hear us, since we could hear them clearly enough, though to be sure the wind was blowing our way. Red Cap said something about the meal being fit for rabbits, not men, and young Ascanius said, "Well, it's not at every meal that you get to eat the table, too." At that, Aeneas looked at him as if startled. After gazing motionless for a minute, he stood up. They all looked up at him.
"That is the omen," he said, his voice ringing clear and solemn. "When hunger drives you to eat your tables, there will be your journey's end. You remember what the harpy said to us?"
A murmur of assent and awe ran among them all. Those travel-weary men and boys and few women sitting there on the grass above the river. They didn't take their eyes off Aeneas.
"Euryalus, bring me a myrtle bough," he said.
And Redcap ran to break off a bough. Aeneas bent it into a wreath to cover his head and stretched out his arms, his hands palm up to the sky. He said,
"Dear faithful gods of the house of Troy, this is your promised land at last. We are home, my people. We have come home."
He looked round at them all, and his face shone with tears. He prayed again.
"Hear us, spirit of this place, and spirits and rivers we do not yet know. Night and the rising stars. My father in the underworld, and my mother in the heavens, hear our prayer."
Then he turned round and drew a deep breath.
"Achates!"
he shouted in a tremendous voice.
"Tell them to bring the wine up from the ship."
At that moment, Sylvia nudged me. Seven or eight men with bows and arrows were trotting in single file across the clearing to our left. It was time for us to be out of there. We crept under the shelter of the cork oaks into thick woods to our right, and threw them back over the crest of the hill, and so down the way we'd come. We were home before evening. At the farm, Sylvia turned to me and gave me a big hug. We were both sweaty from our long run. We stuck to each other when we hugged. We laughed, and Sylvia said, "That was a good idea, going there." So we parted for the last time.